Chapter 49. The Nature of Wild Things. As with all truly wild things, care is necessary in approaching them. Stealth is useless. Wild things recognize stealth for what it is, a lie and a trap. While wild things might play games of stealth, and in doing so may even occasionally fall prey to stealth, they are never truly caught by it. So, with slow care rather than stealth, we must approach the subject of a certain woman. Her wildness is of such degree, I fear approaching her too quickly even in a story. Should I move recklessly, I might startle even the idea of her into sudden flight. So in the name of slow care, I will speak of how I met her. And to do that, I must speak of the events that brought me, quite unwillingly, across the river and into Imre. I finished my first term with 3 silver talents and a single jot. Not long ago, it would have seemed like all the money in the world to me. Now, I simply hoped it would be enough for 1 more term's tuition and a bunk in the mews. The last span of every term at the university was reserved for admissions exams. Classes were cancelled, and the masters spent several hours of each day conducting examinations. Your next term's tuition was based on your performance. A lottery determined what day and hour you would go through admissions. A great deal hung on the brief interview. Missing a few questions could easily double your tuition. Because of this, slots later in the span were highly prized, as they gave students more time to study and prepare. There was a vigorous trade in appointment times after the lottery was held. Money and favors were bartered as everyone vied for a time that suited them. I was lucky enough to draw mid-morning hour on Kendling, the last day of admissions. If I'd wanted to, I could have sold my slot, but I preferred to take the extra time to study. I knew my performance would have to be brilliant, as several of the masters were now less than impressed by me. My previous trick of spying was out of the question. I now knew it was grounds for expulsion, and I couldn't risk that. Despite the long days I spent studying with Will and Sim, admissions were difficult. I breezed through many of the questions, but Hem was openly hostile, asking questions with more than one answer so that nothing I said could be correct. Brandur was difficult as well, clearly helping Hem carry his grudge. Lauren was unreadable, but I sensed his disapproval rather than seeing it on his face. Afterward, I fidgeted while the masters discussed my tuition. Voices were calm and muted at first, then became somewhat louder. Eventually, Kilvin stood and shook a finger at Hem while shouting and pounding the table with his other hand. Hem maintained more composure than I would have if I had been faced with 20 stone of furious, bellowing artificer. After the Chancellor managed to regain control of things, I was called forward and given my receipt. Elir Kvolf, fall term, tuition 3 talents, 9 and 7. 8 jots more than I had. As I walked out of the master's hall, I ignored the sinking feeling in my gut and tried to think of a way I could lay hands on more money by tomorrow noon. I made a brief stop at the 2 Sealdish money changers on this side of the river. As I suspected, they wouldn't lend me a thin shim. While I wasn't surprised, the experience was sobering, reminding me again of how different I was from the other students. They had families paying their tuition, granting them allowances to cover their living expenses. They had reputable names they could borrow against in a pinch. They had possessions they could pawn or sell. If worse came to worst, they had homes to return to. I had none of these things. If I couldn't come up with 8 more jots for tuition, I had nowhere in the world I could go. Borrowing from a friend seemed like the simplest option, but I valued my handful of friends too much to risk losing them over money. As my father used to say, "There are 2 sure ways to lose a friend. One is to borrow, the other to lend." Besides, I did my best to keep my desperate poverty to myself. Pride is a foolish thing, but it is a powerful force. I wouldn't ask them for money except as my very last resort. I briefly considered trying to cut-purse the money, but I knew it was a bad idea. If I were caught with my hand in someone's pocket, I would get more than a cuff around the head. At best, I'd be jailed and forced to stand against the iron law. At worst, I'd end up on the horns and expelled for conduct unbecoming a member of the Arcanum. I couldn't risk it. I needed a Galet, one of the dangerous men who lend money to desperate people. You might have heard them referred to romantically as Copperhawks, but more often they're referred to as Shimgalls, or Lets. Regardless of the name, they exist everywhere. The hard part is finding them. They tend to be rather secretive, as their business is semi-legal at best. But living in Tarbian had taught me a thing or two. I spent a couple of hours visiting the seedier taverns around the university, making casual conversations, asking casual questions. Then I visited a pawn shop called the Bent Penny and asked a few more pointed questions. Finally, I learned where I needed to go, over the river to Imre. Chapter 50. Negotiations. Imre lay a little over 2 miles from the university, on the eastern side of the Omethi River. Since it was a mere 2 days in a fast coach from Tarbian, a great many wealthy nobles, politicians, and courtiers made their homes there. It was conveniently close to the governing hub of the Commonwealth, while being a comfortable distance from the smell of rotten fish, hot tar, and the vomit of drunken sailors. Imre was a haven for the arts. There were musicians, dramatists, sculptors, dancers, and the practitioners of 100 other smaller arts. Even the lowest art of all, poetry. Performers came because Imre offered what every artist needs most, an appreciative, affluent audience. Imre also benefited by its proximity to the university. Access to plumbing and sympathy lamps improved the quality of the town's air. Quality glass was easy to come by, so windows and mirrors were commonplace. Eyeglasses and other ground lenses, while expensive, were readily available. Despite this, there was little love lost between the two towns. Most of Imre's citizens did not like the thought of 1,000 minds tinkering with dark forces better left alone. Listening to the average citizen speak, it was easy to forget that this part of the world had not seen an Arcanist burned for nearly 300 years. To be fair, it should be mentioned that the university had a vague contempt for Imre's populace too, viewing them as self-indulgent and decadent. The arts that were viewed so highly in Imre were seen as frivolous by those at the university. Often, students who quit the university were said to have gone over the river, the implication being that minds that were too weak for academia had to settle for tinkering with the arts. And both sides of the river were ultimately hypocrites. University students complained about frivolous musicians and fluffhead actors, then lined up to pay for performances. Imre's population griped about unnatural arts being practiced 2 miles away, but when an aqueduct collapsed or someone fell suddenly sick, they were quick to call on engineers and doctors trained at the university. All in all, it was a long-standing and uneasy truce where both sides complained while maintaining a grudging tolerance. Those people did have their uses after all. You just wouldn't want your daughter marrying one. Since Imre was such a haven for music and drama, you might think I spent a great deal of time there, but nothing could be further from the truth. I had been there only once. Willem and Simon had taken me to an inn where a trio of skilled musicians played, lute, flute, and drum. I bought a short beer for halfpenny and relaxed, fully intending to enjoy an evening with my friends. But I couldn't. Bare minutes after the music started, I practically fled the room. I doubt very much you'll be able to understand why, but I suppose I have to explain if things are to make any sense at all. I couldn't stand being near music and not be a part of it. It was like watching the woman you love bedding down with another man. No, not really. It was like... It was like the sweet eaters I'd seen in Tarbian. Dener resin was highly illegal, of course, but that didn't matter in most parts of the city. The resin was sold wrapped in waxy paper, like a sucking candy or a toffee. Chewing it filled you with euphoria, bliss, contentment. But after a few hours, you were shaking, filled with a desperate hunger for more, and that hunger grew worse the longer you used it. Once in Tarbian, I saw a young girl of no more than 16 with the telltale hollow eyes and unnaturally white teeth of the hopelessly addicted. She was begging a sailor for a sweet, which he held tauntingly out of reach. He told her it was hers if she stripped naked and danced for him right there in the street. She did, not caring who might be watching, not caring that it was nearly midwinter, and she stood in 4 inches of snow. She pulled off her clothes and danced desperately, her thin limbs pale and shaking, her movements pathetic and jerky. Then, when the sailor laughed and shook his head, she fell to her knees in the snow, begging and weeping, clutching frantically at his legs, promising him anything, anything. That is how I felt, watching the musicians play. I couldn't stand it. The everyday lack of my music was like a toothache I had grown used to. I could live with it. But having what I wanted dangled in front of me was more than I could bear. So I avoided Imre until the problem of my second term's tuition forced me back across the river. I had learned that Devi was the person anyone could ask for a loan, no matter how desperate the circumstances. So I crossed the Omethi by Stonebridge and made my way to Imre. Devi's place of business was through an alley and up a narrow balcony staircase behind a butcher's shop. This part of Imre reminded me of Waterside in Tarbian. The cloying smell of rancid fat from the butcher's shop below made me thankful for the cool autumn breeze. I hesitated in front of the heavy door, looking down into the alley. I was about to become involved in dangerous business. A Sealdish moneylender could take you to court if you didn't repay your loan. A Gaelic would simply have you beaten, or robbed, or both. This was not smart. I was playing with fire. But I didn't have any better options. I took a deep breath, squared my shoulders, and knocked on the door. I wiped my sweaty palms against my cloak, hoping to keep them reasonably dry for when I shook Debbie's hand. I had learned in Tarbian that the best way to deal with this type of man was to act with confidence and self-assurance. They were in the business of taking advantage of other people's weakness. I heard the sound of a heavy bolt being drawn back. Then the door opened, revealing a young girl with straight, strawberry blonde hair framing a pixie-like face. She smiled at me, cute as a new button.
Yes?
I'm looking for Devi, I said.
You found her, she said easily. Come on in.
I stepped inside and she closed the door behind her, sliding the iron bolt home. The room was windowless, but well lit and filled with the scent of lavender, a welcome change from the smell of the alley. There were hangings on the walls, but the only real furniture was a small desk, a bookshelf, and a large canopy bed with the curtains drawn around it.
Please, she said, gesturing to the desk. Have a seat.
She settled herself behind the desk, folding her hands across the top. The way she carried herself made me rethink her age. I'd misjudged her because of her small size, but even so, she couldn't be much older than her early 20s. Hardly what I had expected to find. Devi blinked prettily at me. I need a loan, I said.
How about your name first? She smiled.
You already know mine. Quoth.
Really?
She arched an eyebrow. I've heard a thing or two about you. She looked me up and down. I thought you'd be taller. I could say the same. I was caught off balance by the situation. I'd been ready for a muscular thug in negotiations filled with thinly veiled threats and bravado. I didn't know what to make of this smiling waif.
What have you heard? I asked to fill the silence. Nothing bad, I hope.
Good and bad, she grinned. But nothing boring.
I folded my hands to keep from fidgeting.
So how exactly do we do this?
Not much for banter, are you? She said, giving a brief, disappointed sigh.
Fair enough. Straight to business. How much do you need?
Only about a talent, I said. 8 jots, actually.
She shook her head seriously, her strawberry blonde hair swinging back and forth.
I can't do that, I'm afraid. It's not worth my while to make halfpenny loans.
I frowned. How much is worth your while?
4 talents, she said. That's the minimum.
And the interest?
50% every 2 months. So if you're looking to borrow as little as possible, it'll be 2 talents at the end of the term. You can pay off the whole debt for 6 if you like, but until I get all the principal back, it's 2 talents every term.
I nodded, not terribly surprised. It was roughly 4 times what the most avaricious moneylender would charge.
But I'm paying interest on money I don't really need.
No, she said, meeting my eyes seriously. You're paying interest on money you borrowed. That's the deal.
How about 2 talents? I said. Then at the end...
Devi waved her hands, cutting me off. We aren't bargaining here. I'm just informing you as to the conditions of the loan.
She smiled apologetically. I'm sorry. I didn't make that clear from the beginning.
I looked at her. The set of her shoulders. The way she met my eyes.
Okay, I said, resigned. Where do I sign?
She gave me a slightly puzzled look, her forehead furrowing slightly.
No need to sign anything.
She opened a drawer and pulled out a small brown bottle with a glass stopper. She laid a long pin next to it on the desk.
Just a little blood.
I sat frozen in my chair, my arms at my side.
Don't worry, she reassured me. The pin's clean. I only need about 3 good drops.
I finally found my voice. You've got to be kidding.
Devi cocked her head to one side, a tiny smile curling one edge of her mouth.
You didn't know? She said, surprised. It's rare that anyone comes here without knowing the whole story.
I can't believe anyone actually...
I stalled, at a loss for words.
Not everyone does, she said. I usually do business with students and ex-students. Folks on this side of the river would think I was some sort of witch or a demon or some nonsense like that. Members of the Arcanum know exactly why I want blood and what I can do with it.
You're a member of the Arcanum, too?
Former, she said, her smile fading a little. I made Relar before I left. I know enough so that with a little blood you can never hide from me. I can douse you out anywhere.
Among other things, I said incredulously, thinking of the wax mommet I made of hem at the beginning of the term. That was just hair. Blood was much more effective at creating a link.
You could kill me.
She gave me a frank look. You're awfully thick to be the Arcanum's bright new star. Think it through. Would I stay in business if I made a habit of malfeasance?
The masters know about this?
She laughed.
God's body, of course not. Neither does the constable, the bishop, or my mother.
She pointed to her chest, then to me. I know, and you know. That's usually enough to ensure a good working relationship between the two of us.
What about unusually? I asked. What if I don't have your money at the end of the term? What then?
She spread her hands and shrugged carelessly.
Then we work something out between the two of us. Like rational people. Maybe you work for me. Tell me secrets. Do me favors.
She smiled and gave me a slow, lecherous looking over, laughing at my discomfiture.
If worse comes to worst, and you end up being extraordinarily uncooperative, I could probably sell your blood to someone to recover my loss. Everyone has enemies.
She shrugged easily. But I've never had things descend to that level. The threat is usually enough to keep people in line.
She looked at the expression on my face, and her shoulders slumped a little.
Come on now, she said gently. You came here expecting some thick-necked galet with scarred knuckles. You were ready to make a deal with someone ready to beat 12 distinct colors of hell out of you if you were a day late. My way is better. Simpler. This is insane, I said, getting to my feet. Absolutely not. Devi's cheerful expression faded. Get a hold of yourself, she said, plainly growing exasperated. You're acting like some farmer who thinks I'm trying to buy his soul. It's just a little blood so I can keep tabs on you. It's like collateral. She made a calming gesture with both hands, as if smoothing the air. Fine. I'll tell you what. I'll let you borrow half the minimum. She looked at me expectantly. 2 talents. Does that make it easier? No, I said. I'm sorry to have wasted your time, but I can't do it. Are there any other galets around? Of course, she said coolly. But I don't feel particularly inclined to give out that sort of information. She tilted her head quizzically. By the way, today's kindling, isn't it? Don't you need your tuition by noon tomorrow? I'll find them on my own, then, I snapped. I'm sure you will, clever boy like you. Devi waved me away with the back of her hand. Feel free to let yourself out. Think fond thoughts of Devi in 2 months' time when some thug is kicking the teeth out of your pretty little head. After leaving Devi's, I paced the streets of Imre, restless and irritated, trying to get my thoughts in order, trying to think of a way around my problem. I had a decent chance of paying off the 2-talent loan. I hoped to move up the ranks in the fishery soon. Once I was allowed to pursue my own projects, I could start earning real money. All I needed was to stay in classes long enough. It was just a matter of time. That's really what I was borrowing. Time. 1 more term. Who knew what opportunities might present themselves in the next 2 months? But even as I tried to talk myself into it, I knew the truth. It was a bad idea. It was begging for trouble. I would swallow my pride and see if Will or Sim or Sovoy could lend me the 8 jots I needed. I sighed, resigning myself to a term of sleeping outside and scavenging meals where I could find them. At least it couldn't be worse than my time in Tarbian. I was just about to head back to the university when my restless pacing took me by a pawn shop's window. I felt the old ache in my fingers. How much for the 7-string lute? I asked. To this day, I do not remember actually entering the store.
4 talents even, the owner said brightly.
I guessed he was new to the job, or drunk. Pawnbrokers are never cheerful, not even in rich cities like Imre.
Ah, I said, not bothering to hide my disappointment. Could I take a look at it? He handed it over. It wasn't much to look at. The grain of the wood was uneven, the varnish rough and scratched. Its frets were made of gut and badly in need of replacing, but that was of little concern to me, as I typically played fretless anyway. The bowl was rosewood, so the sound of it wouldn't be terribly subtle. But on the other hand, rosewood would carry better in a crowded taproom, cutting through the murmur of idle conversation. I tapped the bowl with a finger, and it gave off a resonant hum. Solid, but not pretty. I began to tune it so I would have an excuse to hold it a while longer.
I might be able to go as low as 3 and 5, the man behind the counter said.
My ears pricked up as I heard something in his tone. Desperation. It occurred to me that an ugly, used lute might not sell very well in a city full of nobility and prosperous musicians. I shook my head. The strings are old. Actually, they were fine, but I hoped he didn't know that.
True, he said, reassuring me of his ignorance, but strings are cheap.
I suppose, I said doubtfully. With a deliberate plan, I set each of the strings just a hair out of tune with the others. I struck a chord and listened to the grating sound. I gave the lute's neck a sour, speculative look. I think the neck might be cracked. I strummed a minor chord that sounded even less appealing. Does that sound cracked to you? I strummed it again, harder.
3 and 2?
He asked hopefully. It's not for me, I said, as if correcting him. It's for my little brother. The little bastard won't leave mine alone. I strummed again and grimaced. I may not like the little sprit very much, but I'm not cruel enough to buy him a lute with a sour neck. I paused significantly. When nothing was forthcoming, I prompted him. Not for 3 and 2.
3 even? He said hopefully.
To all appearances, I held the lute casually, carelessly, but in my heart, I was clutching it with a white-knuckled fierceness. I cannot hope for you to understand this. When the Chandrian killed my troop, they destroyed every piece of my family and home I had ever known. But in some ways, it had been worse when my father's lute was broken in Tarbian. It had been like losing a limb, an eye, a vital organ. Without my music, I had wandered Tarbian for years, half alive, like a crippled veteran or one of the walking dead. Listen, I said to him frankly, I've got 2 and 2 for you. I pulled out my purse. You can take it, or this ugly thing can gather dust on a high shelf for the next 10 years. I met his eye, careful to keep my face from showing how badly I needed it. I would do anything to keep this loot. I would dance naked in the snow. I would clutch at his legs, shaking and frantic, promising him anything, anything. I counted out 2 talents and 2 jots onto the counter between us, nearly all of the money I had saved for this term's tuition. Each coin made a hard click as I pressed it to the table. He gave me a long look, measuring me. I clicked down 1 more jot and waited. And waited. When he finally reached out his hand for the money, his haggard expression was the same one I was used to seeing on pawnbrokers' faces. Devi opened the door and smiled. Well now, I honestly didn't think I'd see you again. Come in. She bolted the door behind me and walked over to her desk. I can't say I'm disappointed, though. She looked over her shoulder and flashed me her impish smile. I was looking forward to doing a little business with you. She sat down. So, 2 talents, then? 4 would be better, actually, I said. Just enough for me to afford tuition and a bunk in the mews. I could sleep outside in the wind and the rain. My lute deserved better. Wonderful, she said as she pulled out the bottle and pin. I needed the tips of my fingers intact, so I pricked the back of my hand and let 3 drops of blood slowly gather and fall into the small brown bottle. I held it out to Devi. Go ahead and drop the pin in there, too. I did. Devi swabbed the bottle's stopper with a clear substance and slid it into the mouth of the bottle. A clever little adhesive from your friends over the river, she explained. This way, I can't open the bottle without breaking it. When you pay off your debt, you get it back intact and can sleep safe knowing I haven't kept any for myself. Unless you have the solvent, I pointed out. Devi gave me a pointed look. You're not big on trust, are you? She rummaged around in a drawer, brought out some sealing wax, and began to warm it over the lamp on her desk. I don't suppose you have a seal, or ring, or anything like that? She asked as she smeared the wax across the top of the bottle stopper. If I had jewelry to sell, I wouldn't be here, I said frankly, and pressed my thumb into the wax. It left a recognizable print. But that should do. Devi etched a number on the side of the bottle with a diamond stylus, then brought out a slip of paper. She wrote for a moment, then fanned it with a hand, waiting for it to dry. You can take this to any moneylender on either side of the river, she said cheerfully as she handed it to me. Pleasure doing business with you. Don't be a stranger. I headed back to the university with money in my purse and the comforting weight of the lute strap hanging from my shoulder. It was second-hand, ugly, and had cost me dearly in money, blood, and peace of mind. I loved it like a child, like breathing, like my own right hand.
Chapter 51, Tar and Tin. At the beginning of my second term, Kilvin gave me permission to study sigildry. This raised a few eyebrows, but none in the fishery where I'd proven myself to be a hard worker and a dedicated student. Sigildry, simply put, is a set of tools for channeling forces, like sympathy made solid. For example, if you engraved one brick with the rune Ul and another with the rune Dok, the two runes would cause the bricks to cling to each other, as if mortared in place. But it's not as simple as that. What really happens is the two runes tear the bricks apart with the strength of their attraction. To prevent this, you have to add the rune Aru to each of the bricks. Aru is the rune for clay, and it makes the two pieces of clay cling to each other, solving your problem. Except that Aru and Dok don't fit together. They're the wrong shape. To get them to fit, you have to add a few linking runes, Gia and Te. Then, for balance, you have to add Gia and Te to the other brick, too. Then the bricks cling to each other without breaking. But only if the bricks are made out of clay. Most bricks aren't, so generally, it is a better idea to mix iron into the ceramic of the brick before it is fired. Of course, that means you have to use fair instead of aru. Then you have to switch te and gia so the ends come together properly. As you can see, mortar is a simpler and more reliable route for holding bricks together. I studied my sigildry under Kamar. The scarred, one-eyed man was Kilvin's gatekeeper. Only after you were able to prove your firm grasp of sigildry to him could you move on to a loose apprenticeship with one of the more experienced artificers. You assisted them with their projects, and in return, they showed you the finer points of the craft. There were 197 runes. It was like learning a new language, except there were nearly 200 unfamiliar letters, and you had to invent your own words a lot of the time. Most students took at least a month of study before Kamer judged them ready to move on. Some students took an entire term. Start to finish, it took me 7 days. How? First, I was driven. Other students could afford to stroll through their studies. Their parents or patrons would cover the expense. I, on the other hand, needed to climb the ranks in the fishery quickly so I could earn money working on my own projects. Tuition wasn't even my first priority anymore. Devi was. Second, I was brilliant. Not just your run-of-the-mill brilliance, either. I was extraordinarily brilliant. Lastly, I was lucky, plain and simple. I stepped across the patchwork rooftops of Mainz with my lute strung across my back. It was a dim, cloudy twilight, but I knew my way around by now. I kept to the tar and tin, knowing that red tiles or gray slate made for treacherous footing. At some point in the remodeling of Mainz, one of the courtyards had become completely isolated. It could only be accessed by clambering through a high window in one of the lecture halls, or by climbing down a gnarled apple tree, if you happened to be on the roof. I came here to practice my lute. My bunk in Muse was not convenient. Not only was music viewed as frivolous on this side of the river, but I would only make more enemies by playing while my bunkmates tried to sleep or study. So I came here. It was perfect, secluded and practically on my doorstep. The hedges had gone wild and the lawn was a riot of weeds and flowering plants, but there was a bench under the apple tree that was perfectly suited to my needs. Usually I came late at night when Mainz was locked and abandoned. But today was Thaden. That meant that if I ate dinner quickly, I had nearly an hour between Elksadal's class and my work in the fishery, plenty of time for some practice. However, when I reached the courtyard tonight, I saw lights through the windows. Brandur's lecture was running late today. So I stayed on the rooftop. The windows to the lecture hall were shut, so there wasn't much chance of my being overheard.
I put my back to a nearby chimney and began to play. After about 10 minutes, the lights went out, but I decided to stay where I was rather than waste time climbing down. I was halfway through 10 Tap Tim when the sun slipped out from behind the clouds. Golden light covered the rooftop, spilling over the edge of the roof into a thin slice of the courtyard below. That's when I heard the noise. A sudden rustling, like a startled animal down in the courtyard. But then there was something else. A noise unlike anything a squirrel or rabbit would make in the hedge. It was a hard noise, a vaguely metallic thud, as if someone had dropped a heavy bar of iron. I stopped playing. The half-finished melody still running through my head. Was another student down there listening? I put my lute back in its case before I made my way over to the lip of the roof and looked down. I couldn't see through the thick hedge that covered most of the eastern edge of the courtyard. Had a student climbed through the window? The sunset was fading quickly, and by the time I made it down the apple tree, most of the courtyard lay in shadow. I could see from here that the high window was closed. No one had come in that way. Even though it was quickly growing dark, curiosity won over caution, and I made my way into the hedge. There was quite a lot of space there. Portions of the hedge were nearly hollow, a green shell of living branches, leaving enough room to crouch comfortably. I made note of the place as a good space for sleeping if I didn't have enough money for a bunk in the mews next term. Even in the fading light, I could see I was the only one there. There wasn't room for anything bigger than a rabbit to hide. In the dim light, I couldn't spot anything that could have made the metallic noise, either. Humming the catchy chorus of 10 Tap Tim, I crawled through to the other end of the hedge. Only when I came through the other side did I notice the drainage grate. I'd seen similar ones scattered throughout the university, but this one was older and larger. In fact, the opening might be large enough for a person to fit through if the grate were removed. Hesitantly, I curled a hand around one of the cool metal bars and pulled. The heavy grate pivoted on a hinge and came up about 3 inches before stopping. In the dim light, I couldn't tell why it wouldn't go any further. I pulled harder, but couldn't budge it. Finally, I gave up and dropped it back into place. It made a hard noise, vaguely metallic, like someone had dropped a heavy bar of iron. Then my fingers felt something that my eyes missed, a maze of grooves etching the surface of the bars. I looked closer and recognized some of the runes I was learning under Kamar, Ul and Dok. Then something clicked in my head. The chorus of 10 Tap Tim suddenly fit together with the runes I'd been studying under Kamar for the last handful of days. Ul and Dok are both for binding. Re for seeking, Kel for finding. Gia ki, te lak. Pesin water, resin rock. Before I could go any further, 6th bell struck. The sound startled me from my reverie. But when I reached out to steady myself, my hand didn't come to rest on leaves and dirt. I touched something round and hard and smooth. A green apple. I emerged from the hedge and made my way to the northwest corner where the apple tree stood. No apples were on the ground. It was too early in the year for that. What's more, the iron grate was on the opposite side of the small courtyard. It couldn't have rolled that far. It must have been carried. Unsure of what to think, but knowing I was late for my evening shift in the fishery, I climbed the apple tree, gathered up my loot, and hurried to Kilvin's shop. Later that night, I fit the rest of the runes to music. It took a few hours, but when I was done, it was like having a reference sheet in my head. The next day, Kamar put me through an extensive 2-hour examination, which I passed. For the next stage of my education in the fishery, I was apprenticed to Manette, the old, wild-haired student I'd met during my first days at the university. Manette had been attending the university for nearly 30 years, and everyone knew him as the Eternal Elir. But despite the fact that we held the same rank, Manette had more hands-on experience in the fishery than any dozen higher-ranking students combined. Manette was patient and considerate. In fact, he reminded me of my old teacher, Abanthi. Except Abinthy had wandered the world like a restless tinker, and it was common knowledge that Manette desired nothing more than to stay at the university for the rest of his life if he could manage it. Manette started small, teaching me simple formulae of the sort required for twice-tough glass and heat funnels. Under his tutelage, I learned artificing as quickly as I learned everything, and it wasn't long before we worked our way up to more complex projects like heat eaters and sympathy lamps. Truly high-level artificing, such as sympathy clocks or gear winds, were still beyond my reach, but I knew that it was just a matter of time. Unfortunately, time was proving to be in short supply. Chapter 52. Burning. Owning a lute again meant I had my music back, but I quickly realized I was 3 years out of practice. My work in the artificery over the last couple months had toughened and strengthened my hands, but not in entirely the right ways. It took several frustrating days before I could play comfortably for even an hour at a time. I might have progressed more quickly had I not been so busy with my other studies. I had 2 hours of each day in the medica, running or standing, an average of 2 hours of lecture and ciphering each day in mathematics, and 3 hours of studying under Manette in the fishery, learning the tricks of the trade. And then there was advanced sympathy with Elxadal. Out of class, Elxadal was charming, soft-spoken, and even a little ridiculous when the mood was on him. But when he taught, his personality strode back and forth between mad prophet and galley-slave drummer. Every day in his class, I burned another 3 hours of time and 5 hours' worth of energy. Combined with my paid work in Kilvin's shop, this left me with barely enough time to eat, sleep, and study, let alone give my lute the time it deserved. Music is a proud, temperamental mistress. Give her the time and attention she deserves, and she is yours. Slight her, and there will come a day when you call and she will not answer. So I began sleeping less to give her the time she needed. After a span of this schedule, I was tired. After 3 span, I was still fine, but only through a grim, set-jaw type of determination. Somewhere around the 5th span, I began to show definite signs of wear. It was during that 5th span that I was enjoying a rare, shared lunch with Willem and Simon. They had their lunches from a nearby tavern. I couldn't afford a drab for an apple and meat pie, so I had snuck some barley bread and a gristly sausage out of the mess. We sat on the stone bench beneath the pennant pole where I'd been whipped. The place had filled me with dread after my whipping, but I forced myself to spend time there to prove to myself that I could. After it no longer unnerved me, I sat there because the stares of the students amused me. Now I sat there because I was comfortable. It was my place. And because we spent a fair amount of time together, it had become Willem and Simmons' place, too. If they thought my choice an odd one, they didn't speak of it.
"You haven't been around very much,"
Willem said around a mouthful of meat pie.
"Been sick?"
"Right," Simon said sarcastically. "He's been sick a whole month." Willem glared at him and grumbled, reminding me of Kilvin for a moment. His expression made Simon laugh. "Will's more polite than I am. I'm betting you've been spending all your free hours walking to Imre and back, courting some fabulously attractive young bard." He gestured at the loot case that lay at my side.
"He looks like he's been sick."
Willem looked at me with a critical eye.
"Your woman hasn't been taking care of you."
"He's lovesick," Simon said knowingly. "Can't eat, can't sleep. You think of her when you should be trying to memorize your cipher." I couldn't think of anything to say.
"See," Simon said to Will, "she's stolen his tongue as well as his heart. All his words are for her. He can spare none for us." "Can't spare any time either," Willem said into his rapidly dwindling meat pie.
It was true, of course. I had been neglecting my friends even more than I'd been neglecting myself. I felt a flush of guilt wash over me. I couldn't tell them the full truth, that I needed to make the most of this term because it would very likely be my last. I was flat broke.
If you cannot understand why I couldn't bring myself to tell them this, then I doubt you have ever been truly poor. I doubt you can really understand how embarrassing it is to only own 2 shirts, to cut your own hair as best you can because you can't afford a barber. I lost a button and couldn't spare a shim to buy a matching one. I tore out the knee of my pants and had to make do with the wrong color thread for mending. I couldn't afford salt for my meals or drinks on my rare evenings out with friends. The money I earned in Kilvin's shop was spent on essentials, ink, soap, lute strings. The only other thing I could afford was pride. I couldn't bear the thought of my 2 best friends knowing how desperate my situation was. If I suffered a piece of extraordinary good luck, I might be able to muster 2 talents to pay the interest on my debt to Devi. But it would require a direct act of God for me to somehow gather enough money to pay that and next term's tuition as well. After I was forced out of the university and squared my debt with Devi, I didn't know what I'd do. Pull up stakes and head for Annalyn to look for Denna, perhaps. I looked at them, not knowing what to say. Will, Simon, I'm sorry. It's just that I've been so busy lately. Simon grew a little more serious, and I saw that he was earnestly hurt at my unexplained absence. We're busy too, you know. I've got rhetoric and chemistry, and I'm learning Siaru. He turned to Will and scowled. You should know I'm beginning to hate your language, you shim bastard.
To Krylim,
the young Sealed replied amiably. Simon turned back to me and spoke with remarkable candor. It's just that we'd like to see you more often than once every handful of days as you run from mains to the fishery. Girls are wonderful, I'll admit, but when one takes one of my friends away, I get a little jealous. He gave a sudden, sunny smile. Not that I think of you in that way, of course. I found it hard to swallow past the sudden lump in my throat. I couldn't remember the last time I'd been missed. For a long time, I hadn't had anyone to miss me. I felt the beginning of hot tears in the back of my throat. Really, there isn't a girl. I mean it. I swallowed hard, trying to regain my composure.
Sim, I think we've been missing something here.
Willem was looking at me oddly.
Take a good look at him.
Simon gave me a similar analytical stare. That look from the 2 of them was enough to unnerve me, pushing me back from the edge of tears.
Now, Willem said, as if lecturing, how many terms has our young Ilir been attending the university?
Realization poured into Sim's honest face.
Oh!
Anyone care to tell me? I said petulantly. Willem ignored my question.
What classes are you taking?
Everything, I said, glad to have an excuse to complain. Geometry, observation in the Medica, advanced sympathy with Alxadal, and I've got my apprenticeship under Manette in the fishery. Simon looked a little shocked. No wonder you look like you haven't slept in a span of days, he said. Willem nodded to himself.
And you're still working in Kilvin's shop, aren't you?
A couple of hours every night. Simon was aghast. And you're learning an instrument at the same time? Are you insane? The music is the only thing that keeps me grounded, I said, reaching down to touch my lute. And I'm not learning to play. I just need practice. Willem and Simon exchanged looks.
How long do you think he has?
Simon looked me over. Span and a half tops. What do you mean? Willem leaned forward.
We all bite off too much sooner or later, but some students don't know when to spit their mouthful. They burn out. They quit or botch their exams. Some crack.
He tapped his head.
It usually happens to students in their first year.
He gave me a significant look. I haven't bitten off too much, I said.
Look in a mirror,
Willem suggested frankly. I opened my mouth to reassure Will and Sim that I was fine, but just then I heard the hour being struck, and I only had time for a hurried goodbye.
Even so, I had to run to make it to Advanced Sympathy on time. Elxadal stood between two medium-sized braziers. In his well-trimmed beard and dark master's robe, he still reminded me of the stereotypical evil magician that appears in so many bad Aeturan plays. "What each of you must remember is that the Sympathist is tied to flame," he said. "We are its master and its servant." He tucked his hands into his long sleeves and began to pace again. "We are the masters of fire, for we have dominion over it." Elxadal struck a nearby brazier with the flat of his hand, making it ring softly. Flames kindled in the coal and began to lick hungrily upward. "The energy in all things belongs to the Arcanist. We command fire, and fire obeys." Dahl walked slowly to the other corner of the room. The brazier at his back dimmed, while the other one he walked towards sparked to life and began to burn. I appreciated his showmanship. Dahl stopped and faced the class again. "But we are also servants of fire, because fire is the most common form of energy, and without energy, our prowess as sympathists is of little use." He turned his back to the class and began erasing formulae from the slate board. "Gather your materials, and we'll see who has to knock heads with Elia Quoth today." He began to chalk up a list of all the students' names. Mine was at the top. 3 span ago, Dahl had started making us compete against each other. He called it dueling. And though it was a welcome break from the monotony of lecture, this most recent activity had a sinister element, too. 100 students left the Arcanum every year, perhaps a quarter of them with their guilders. That meant that every year there were 100 more people in the world that had been trained in the use of sympathy. People who, for one reason or another, you might have to pit your will against later in life. Though Dahl never said as much, we knew we were being taught something beyond mere concentration and ingenuity. We were being taught how to fight. Elxadal kept careful track of the results. In the class of 38, I was the only one to remain undefeated. By this point, even the most thick-headed and grudging students were being forced to admit that my quick admittance to the Arcanum was something other than a fluke. Dueling could also be profitable in a small way, as there was a bit of clandestine betting. When we wanted to bet on our own duels, Savoy and I placed bets for each other, though as a rule I usually didn't have much money to spare. Thus, it was no coincidence that Savoy and I bumped into each other while we were gathering our materials. I handed him 2 jots underneath the table. He slid them into his pocket without looking at me.
"Goodness," he said quietly, "someone's pretty confident today."
I shrugged nonchalantly, though in truth I was a little nervous. I had started the term penniless and been scraping by ever since, but yesterday Kilvin had paid me for a span's work in the fishery, 2 jots. All the money I had in the world. Savoy began to rummage around in a drawer, bringing out sympathy wax, twine, and a few pieces of metal. "I don't know how well I'll be able to do for you. The odds are getting bad. I'm guessing 3-1 is the best you'll get today. You still interested if it gets that low?" I sighed. The odds were the downside to my undefeated rank. Yesterday, they had been 2-1, meaning I would have had to risk 2 pennies for the chance to win 1. "I've got a little something planned," I said. "Don't bet until we've set terms. You should get at least 3-1 against me."
"Against you?" he muttered as he gathered up an armful of paraphernalia. "Not unless you're going up against Dahl."
I turned my face to conceal a slightly embarrassed blush at the compliment. Dahl clapped his hands and everyone rushed to take their proper place. I was paired with a Vintish boy, Fenton. He was 1 step below me in the class ranking. I respected him as one of the few in the class that could pose a real challenge to me in the right situation.
"Right, then," Elxadal said, rubbing his hands together eagerly. "Fenton, you're lower on the ranks. Pick your poison."
"Candles."
"And your link?"
Dahl asked ritualistically. With candles, it was always either wicking or wax.
Wick!
He held up a piece for everyone to see. Dahl turned to me. Link? I dug into a pocket and held up my link with a flourish.
Straw!
There was a murmur from the class at this. It was a ridiculous link. The best I could hope for is a 3% transfer, maybe 5. Fenton's wicking would be 10 times better.
Straw?
Straw, I said with slightly more confidence than I felt. If this didn't tip the odds against me, I didn't know what would.
Straw it is, then, Dahl said easily. Elia Fenton, since Quoth is undefeated, you will have the choice of sauce.
A quiet laugh spread through the class. My stomach dropped. I hadn't expected that. Normally, whoever doesn't pick the game gets to choose the source. I had been planning on choosing Brazier, knowing that the quantity of heat would help offset my self-imposed handicap. Fenton grinned, knowing his advantage.
No source!
I grimaced. All we would have to draw from was our own body heat. Difficult in the best of circumstances, not to mention a little dangerous. I couldn't win. Not only was I going to lose my perfect rank, I had no way to signal Savoy not to bet my last 2 jots. I tried to meet his eyes, but he was already caught up in quiet, intense negotiations with a handful of other students. Fenton and I moved wordlessly to sit on opposite sides of a large work table. Elxadal set 2 thick stumps of candle down, one in front of each of us. The object was to light your opponent's candle without letting him do the same to yours. This involved splitting your mind into 2 different pieces. One piece tried to hold the ailer that your piece of wicking, or straw if you were stupid, was the same as the wick of the candle you were trying to light. Then you drew energy from your source to make it happen. Meanwhile, the second piece of your mind was kept busy trying to maintain the belief that your opponent's piece of wicking was not the same as the wick of your candle. If all of this sounds difficult, believe me, you don't know the half of it. Making it worse was the fact that neither of us had an easy source to draw from. You had to be careful using yourself as a source. Your body is warm for a reason. It responds badly when heat is pulled away. At a gesture from Elxadal, we began. I immediately devoted my whole mind to the defense of my own candle and began to think furiously. There was no way I could win. It doesn't matter how skilled a fencer you are. You can't help but lose when your opponent has a blade of Ramsden steel and you've chosen to fight with a willow switch. I lowered myself into the heart of stone. Then, still devoting most of my mind to the protection of my candle, I muttered a binding between my candle and his. I reached out and tipped my candle on its side, forcing him to make a grab for his before it did the same and rolled away. I tried to take quick advantage of his distraction and set his candle aflame. I threw myself into it and felt a chill bleed up my arm from my right hand that held the piece of straw. Nothing happened. His candle remained cold and dark. I cupped my hand around the wick of my candle, blocking his line of sight. It was a petty trick and largely useless against a skilled sympathist, but my only hope was to rattle him in some way. "Hey, Fen," I said, "have you heard the one about the tinker, the Talon, the farmer's daughter, and the butter churn yet?" Fen gave no response. His pale face was locked in fierce concentration. I gave up distraction as a lost cause. Fenton was too smart to be thrown off that way. Besides, I was finding it difficult to maintain the necessary concentration to keep my candle safe. I lowered myself more deeply into the heart of stone and forgot the world apart from the 2 candles and a piece of wick and straw. After a minute, I was covered in a clammy, chill sweat. I shivered. Fenton saw this and gave me a smile with bloodless lips. I redoubled my efforts, but his candle ignored my best attempts to force it into flame. 5 minutes passed, with the whole class quiet as stones. Most duels lasted no longer than 1 or 2, one person quickly proving himself more clever or possessed of a stronger will. Both my arms were cold now. I saw a muscle in Fenton's neck twitch spastically, like a horse's flank trying to shake loose a biting fly. His posture went rigid as he suppressed the urge to shiver. A wisp of smoke began to curl from the wick of my candle. I bore down. I realized that my breath was hissing through my clenched teeth. My lips pulled back in a feral grin. Fenton didn't seem to notice, his eyes growing glassy and unfocused. I shivered again, so violently that I almost missed seeing the tremor in his hand. Then slowly, Fenton's head began to nod toward the tabletop. His eyelids drooped. I set my teeth and was rewarded to see a thin curl of smoke rise from the wick of his candle. Woodenly, Fenton turned to look, but instead of rallying to his own defense, he made a slow, leaden gesture of dismissal and lay his head in the crook of his arm. He didn't look up as the candle near his elbow spat fitfully to life. There was a brief scattering of applause mixed in with exclamations of disbelief. Someone pounded me on the back.
How about that? Wore himself out!
No, I said thickly and reached across the table. With clumsy fingers, I prized open the hand that held the wicking and saw it had blood on it.
Master Dahl, I said as quickly as I could manage, he's got the chills.
Speaking made me realize how cold my lips felt. But Dahl was already there, bringing a blanket to wrap around the boy.
You, he pointed at one of the students at random. Bring someone from the Medica. Go.
The student left at a run.
Foolish.
Master Dahl murmured a binding for heat. He looked over at me.
You should probably walk around a bit. You don't look much better than he does.
There was no more dueling that day. The rest of the class watched as Fenton revived slowly under Elxadal's care. By the time an older Eltha from the Medica arrived, Fenton had warmed enough to begin shivering violently. After a quarter hour of warm blankets and careful sympathy, Fenton was able to drink something hot, though his hand still shook. Once all the hubbub was finished, it was nearly third bell. Master Dahl managed to get all the students seated and quiet long enough to say a few words.
What we saw today was a prime example of binder's chills. The body is a delicate thing, and a few degrees of heat lost rapidly can upset the entire system. A mild case of the chills is just that, chilling. But more extreme cases can lead to shock and hypothermia.
Dahl looked around.
Can anyone tell me what Fenton's mistake was?
There was a moment of silence, then a hand raised.
Yes, Bray?
He used blood. When heat is lost from the blood, the body cools as a whole unit. This is not always advantageous, as the extremities can stand a more drastic temperature loss than the viscera can.
Why would anyone consider using blood, then?
It offers up more heat more rapidly than the flesh.
How much would have been safe for him to draw?
Dahl looked around the room.
2 degrees?
Someone volunteered.
1.5,
Dahl corrected, and wrote a few equations on the board to demonstrate how much heat this would provide.
Given his symptoms, how much do you suppose he actually drew?
There was a pause. Finally, Savoy spoke up.
8 or 9?
Very good, Dahl said grudgingly. It's nice that at least one of you has been doing the reading. His expression grew grave.
Sympathy is not for the weak of mind, but neither is it for the overconfident. If we had not been here to give Fenton the care he needed, he would have slipped quietly asleep and died.
He paused to let the words sink in.
Better you should know your honest limit than overguess your abilities and lose control.
Third bell struck, and the room was filled with sudden noise as students stood to leave. Master Dahl raised his voice to be heard.
Elia Kvoth, would you mind staying behind for a moment?
I grimaced. Savoy walked behind me, clapped me on the shoulder, and muttered,
Look.
I couldn't tell if he was referring to my victory or wishing me well. After everyone was gone, Dahl turned and set down the rag he had been using to wipe the slate clean.
So, he said conversationally, how did the numbers work out?
I wasn't surprised he knew about the betting. 11-1, I admitted. I'd made 22 jots, a little over 2 talents. The presence of that money in my pocket warmed me.
He gave me a speculative look.
How are you feeling? You were a little pale at the end yourself.
I had a little shiver, I lied. Actually, in the commotion that followed Fenton's collapse, I had slipped out and had a frightening few minutes in a back hallway. Shivers that were close to seizures had made it almost impossible to stay on my feet. Luckily, no one had found me shaking in the hallway, my jaw clenched so tight that I feared my teeth might break. But no one had seen me. My reputation was intact. Dal gave me a look that told me he might suspect the truth.
Come over. He made a motion to one of the still-burning braziers. A little warm won't hurt you.
I didn't argue. As I held my hands to the fire, I felt myself relax a bit. Suddenly, I realized how weary I was. My eyes were itchy from too little sleep. My body felt heavy, as if my bones were made of lead. With a reluctant sigh, I pulled my hands back and opened my eyes. Dal was looking closely at my face.
I've got to go, I said with a little regret in my voice.
Thanks for the use of your fire.
We're both sympathists, Dal said, giving me a friendly wave as I gathered my things and headed for the door. You're welcome to it any time.
Later that night in the mews, Willem opened his door to my knocking.
I'll be damned, he said. 2 times in 1 day. To what do I owe the honor?
I think you know. I grumbled and pushed my way inside the cell-like little room. I leaned my loot case against a wall and fell into a chair. Kilvin has banned me from my work in the shop. Willem sat forward on his bed.
Why's that?
I gave him a knowing look. I expect it's because you and Simmons stopped by and suggested it to him. He watched me for a moment, then shrugged.
You figured it out quicker than I thought you would.
He rubbed the side of his face.
You don't seem terribly upset.
I had been furious. Just as my fortune seemed to be turning, I was forced to leave my only paying job because of well-intentioned meddling by my friends. But rather than storm over and rage at them, I'd gone away to the roof of Maine's and played for a while to cool my head. The music calmed me, as it always did, and while I played, I thought things through. My apprenticeship with Manette was going well, but there was simply too much to learn. How to fire the kilns, how to draw wire to the proper consistency, which alloys to choose for the proper effects. I couldn't hope to bull through it the way I had learning my runes. I couldn't earn enough working in Kilvin's shop to pay back Devi at the end of the month, let alone make enough for tuition, too. I probably would be, I admitted, but Kilvin made me look in a mirror. I gave him a tired smile. I look like hell.
You look like beat-up hell.
He corrected me matter-of-factly, then paused awkwardly.
I'm glad you're not upset.
Simon knocked as he pushed the door open. Guilt chased surprise off his face when he saw me sitting there.
Aren't you supposed to be, in the fishery?
He asked lamely. I laughed, and Simon's relief was almost tangible. Willem moved a stack of paper off another chair, and Simmons slouched into it.
All is forgiven, I said magnanimously. All I ask is this. Tell me everything you know about the Aeolian.
Chapter 53 Slow Circles. The Aeolian is where our long-sought player is waiting in the wings. I have not forgotten that she is what I am moving toward. If I seem to be caught in a slow circling of the subject, it is only appropriate, as she and I have always moved toward each other in slow circles. Luckily, Willem and Simon had both been to the Aeolian. Together, they told me what little I didn't already know. There were a lot of places you could go in Imre to listen to music. In fact, nearly every inn, tavern, and boarding house had some manner of musician strumming, singing, or piping in the background. But the Aeolian was different. It hosted the best musicians in the city.
If you knew good music from bad, you knew the Aeolian had the best. To get in the front door of the Aeolian cost you a whole copper jot. Once you were inside, you could stay as long as you wished and listen to as much music as you liked. But paying at the door did not give a musician the right to play at the Aeolian. A musician who wished to set foot upon the Aeolian stage had to pay for the privilege. 1 silver talent. That's right. Folk paid to play at the Aeolian, not the other way around. Why would anyone pay such an outrageous amount of money simply to play music? Well, some of those who gave their silver were simply the self-indulgent rich. To them, a talent was not a great price to set themselves on such proud display. But serious musicians paid too. If your performance impressed the audience and the owners enough, you were given a token, a tiny set of silver pipes that could be mounted on a pin or necklace. The talent pipes were recognized as clear marks of distinction at most sizable inns within 200 miles of Imre. If you had your set of talent pipes, you were admitted to the Aeolian for free and could play whenever the fancy took you. The only responsibility the talent pipes carried was that of performance. If you had earned your pipes, you could be called upon to play. This was usually not a heavy burden, as the nobility who frequented the Aeolian usually gave money or gifts to performers who pleased them. It was the upper-class version of buying drinks for the fiddler. Some musicians played with little hope of actually gaining their pipes. They paid to play because you never knew who might be in the Aeolian that night listening. A good performance of a single song might not get you your pipes, but it might earn you a wealthy patron instead. A patron. "You'll never guess what I heard," Simmons said one evening as we sat on our usual bench in the Pennant Square. We were alone, as Willem was off making eyes at a serving girl at Anchor's. "Students have been hearing all manner of odd things from Mainz at night."
"Really?" I feigned disinterest.
Simmons pressed on.
"Yes. Some say that it's the ghost of a student who got lost in the building and starved to death."
He tapped the side of his nose with a finger like an old gaffer telling a story. "They say he wanders the halls even to this day, never able to find his way outside."
"Ah."
"Other opinions suggest it's an angry spirit. They say it tortures animals, especially cats. That's the sound the students hear late at night. Tortured cat's guts. Quite a terrifying sound, I understand." I looked at him. He seemed almost ready to burst with laughing.
"Oh, let it out," I told him with mock severity. "Go on. You deserve it for being so terribly clever, despite the fact that no one uses gut strings in this day and age."
He chortled delightedly to himself. I picked up one of his sweet cakes and began to eat it, hoping to teach him a valuable lesson in humility.
"So you're still going at it?"
I nodded.
Simmons looked relieved. "I thought you might have changed your plans. I hadn't seen you carrying your loot around lately."
"Not necessary," I explained. "Now that I have time to practice, I don't have to worry about sneaking in a few minutes whenever I can grab them." A group of students passed by. One of them waved to Simmons.
"When are you going to do it?"
"This morning," I said.
"So soon?" Sim asked.
"It was only 2 span ago that you were worried about being rusty. Has it all come back so quickly?"
"Not all of it," I admitted.
"It'll take years for it all to come back." I shrugged and popped the last of the sweet cake into my mouth. "But it's easy again. The music doesn't stop in my hands anymore. It just..." I struggled to explain, then shrugged. "I'm ready." Honestly, I would have liked another month's practice, another year's practice before gambling away an entire talent. But there was no time. The term was nearly over. I needed money to stave off my debt to Devi and pay my upcoming tuition. I couldn't wait any longer.
"You sure?" Sim asked.
"I've heard people try for their talent that were really good. Early this term, an old man sang a song about this woman whose husband had gone off to war.
In the village smithy," I said.
"Whatever," Simmons said dismissively. "What I'm saying is that he was really good. I laughed and cried and just hurt all over.
He gave me an anxious look. But he didn't get his pipes. I covered my own anxiety with a smile.
You still haven't heard me play, have you?
You know damn well I haven't, he said crossly. I smiled. I had refused to play for Willem and Simon while I was out of practice. Their opinions were nearly as important as those at the Aeolian.
Well, you'll get your chance this morning, I teased.
Will you come?
Simon nodded.
Willem, too, barring earthquakes or rain of blood. I looked up at the sunset.
I should go, I said, getting to my feet.
Practice makes the master. Sim waved, and I headed to the mess, where I sat down long enough to spoon up my beans and chew through a flat piece of tough gray meat. I took my small loaf of bread with me, drawing a few odd looks from the nearby students. I headed to my bunk and retrieved my loot from the trunk at the foot of the bed. Then, given the rumors Sim had mentioned, I took one of the trickier ways onto the roof of Maine's, shimmying up a series of drainpipes in a sheltered box alley. I didn't want to draw any extra attention to my nighttime activities there. It was fully dark by the time I made it to the isolated courtyard with the apple tree. All the windows were dark. I looked down from the edge of the roof, seeing nothing but shadows.
Ari?
I called.
Are you there?
You're late,
came the vaguely petulant reply.
I'm sorry, I said. Do you want to come up tonight?
A slight pause.
No, come down.
There's not much moon tonight, I said in my best encouraging tones. Are you sure you don't want to come up?
I heard a rustle from the hedges below, and then saw Ari scamper up the tree like a squirrel. She ran around the edge of the roof, then pulled up short a few dozen feet away. At my best guess, Ari was only a few years older than me, certainly no more than 20. She dressed in tattered clothes that left her arms and legs bare, was shorter than me by almost a foot. She was thin. Part of this was simply her tiny frame, but there was more to it than that. Her cheeks were hollow, and her bare arms waifishly narrow. Her long hair was so fine that it trailed her, floating in the air like a cloud. It had taken me a long while to draw her out of hiding. I'd suspected someone was listening to me practice from the courtyard, but it had been nearly two span before I caught a glimpse of her. Seeing that she was half-starved, I began bringing whatever food I could carry away from the mess and leaving it for her. Even so, it was another span before she had joined me on the roof as I practiced my lute. The last few days, she'd even started talking. I'd expected her to be sullen and suspicious, but nothing could be further from the truth. She was bright-eyed and enthusiastic. Though I couldn't help but be reminded of myself in Tarbian when I saw her, there was little real resemblance. Ari was scrupulously clean and full of joy. She didn't like the open sky, or bright lights, or people. I guessed she was some student who had gone cracked and run underground before she could be confined to Haven. I hadn't learned much about her, as she was still shy and skittish. When I'd asked her name, she bolted back underground and didn't return for days. So I picked a name for her, Ari. Though in my heart, I always thought of her as my little moon fae. Ari came a few steps closer, stopped, waited, then darted forward again. This she did several times until she stood in front of me. Standing still, her hair spread in the air around her like a halo. She held both her hands in front of her, just under her chin. She reached out and tugged my sleeve, then pulled her hand back.
"What did you bring me?"
she asked excitedly. I smiled.
"What did you bring me?" I teased gently.
She smiled and thrust her hand forward. Something gleamed in the moonlight.
"A key,"
she said proudly, pressing it on me. I took it. It had a pleasing weight in my hand.
"It's very nice," I said. "What does it unlock?"
"The moon,"
she said, her expression grave.
"That should be useful," I said, looking it over.
"That's what I thought," she said. "That way, if there's a door in the moon, you can open it."
She sat cross-legged on the roof and grinned up at me. Not that I would encourage that sort of reckless behavior. I squatted down and opened my loot case. I brought you some bread. I handed her the loaf of brown barley bread wrapped in a piece of cloth. And a bottle of water. This is very nice as well, she said graciously. The bottle seemed very large in her hands. What's in the water? She asked as she pulled out the cork and peered down into it. Flowers, I said. And the part of the moon that isn't in the sky tonight. I put that in there, too. She looked back up. I already said the moon, she said with a hint of reproach. Just flowers, then. And the shine off the back of a dragonfly. I wanted a piece of the moon, but blue dragonfly shine was as close as I could get. She tipped the bottle up and took a sip. It's lovely, she said, brushing back several strands of hair that were drifting in front of her face. Ari spread out the cloth and began to eat. She tore small pieces from the loaf and chewed them delicately, somehow making the whole process look genteel. I like white bread, she said conversationally between mouthfuls. Me too, I said as I lowered myself into a sitting position, when I can get it. She nodded and looked around at the starry night sky and the crescent moon. I like it when it's cloudy, too, but this is okay. It's cozy. Like the underthing. Underthing? I asked. She was rarely this talkative. I live in the underthing, Ari said easily. It goes all over. Do you like it down there? Ari's eyes lit up. Holy God, yes, it's marvelous. You can just look forever. She turned to look at me. I have news, she said teasingly. What's that? I asked. She took another bite and finished chewing before she spoke. I went out last night. A sly smile. On top of things. Really? I said, not bothering to hide my surprise. How did you like it? It was lovely. I went looking around, she said, obviously pleased with herself. I saw Elodin. Master Elodin? I asked. She nodded. Was he on top of things too? She nodded again, chewing. Did he see you? Her smile burst out again, making her look closer to 8 than 18. Nobody sees me. Besides, he was busy listening to the wind. She cupped her hands around her mouth and made a hooting noise. There was good wind for listening last night, she added confidentially. While I was trying to make sense of what she said, Ari finished the last of her bread and clapped her hands excitedly. Now play! She said breathlessly. Play, play! Grinning, I pulled my lute out of its case. I couldn't hope for a more enthusiastic audience than Ari. Chapter 54 A Place to Burn. You look different today, Simon observed. Willem grunted in agreement. I feel different, I admitted. Good, but different. The three of us were kicking up dust on the road to Imray. The day was warm and sunny, and we were in no particular hurry. You look calm, Simon continued, brushing his hand through his hair. I wish I felt as calm as you look. I wish I felt as calm as I look, I mumbled. Simon refused to give up. You look more solid, he grimaced. No, you look tight.
Tight?
Tension forced laughter out of me, leaving me more relaxed. How can someone look tight?
Just tight, he shrugged, like a coiled spring.
It's the way he's holding himself, Willem said, breaking his usual thoughtful silence. Standing straight, neck unbent, shoulders back.
He gestured vaguely to illustrate his point.
When he steps, his whole foot treads the ground, not just the ball as if he would run, or the heel as if he would hesitate. He steps solidly down, claiming the piece of ground for his own.
I felt a momentary awkwardness as I tried to watch myself, always a futile thing to attempt. Simon gave him a sideways look.
Someone's been spending time with Puppet, haven't they?
Willem shrugged, a vague agreement, and threw a stone into the trees by the side of the road. "Who is this puppet you two keep mentioning?" I asked, partly to draw the attention away from myself. "I'm about to die of terminal curiosity, you know."
"If anyone could, it would be you," Willem said.
"He spends most of his time in the archives," Sim said hesitantly, knowing that he was touching on a sore subject. "It would be hard to introduce you, since, you know." We came to Stonebridge, the ancient arch of gray stone that spanned the Omethi River between the university and Imre, over 200 feet from one bank to another, and arching more than 60 feet at its peak. Stonebridge had more stories and legends surrounding it than any other university landmark.
"Spit for luck,"
Willem urged, as we began to climb one side and followed his own advice. Simon followed suit, spitting over the side with a childlike exuberance. I almost said, "Luck has nothing to do with it." Master Arwell's words repeated sternly 1,000 times in the Medica. I tasted them on the tip of my tongue for a minute, hesitated, then spat instead. The Aeolian lay at the heart of Imre, its front doors facing out onto the city's central cobblestone courtyard. There were benches, a few flowering trees, and a marble fountain misting water over a statue of a satyr chasing a group of half-clothed nymphs whose attempts at flight seemed token at best. Well-dressed people milled around, nearly 1/3 carrying some sort of musical instrument or another. I counted at least 7 lutes. As we approached the Aeolian, the doorman tugged at the front of a wide-brimmed hat and made a nodding bow. He was at least 6.5 feet tall, deeply tanned, and muscular.
"That will be 1 jot, young master."
He smiled as Willem handed over a coin. He turned to me next with the same sunny smile. Looking at the loot case I carried, he cocked an eyebrow at me.
"Good to see a new face. You know the rules?"
I nodded and handed him a jot. He turned to point inside.
"You'll see the bar?"
It was hard to miss 50 feet of winding mahogany that curved through the far end of the room.
"See where the far end turns toward the stage?"
I nodded.
"See him on the stool? If you decide to try for your pipes, he's the one you want to talk to. Name's Stanchion."
We both turned away from the room at the same time. I shrugged my lute higher onto my shoulder. "Thank you." I paused, not knowing his name.
"Diok."
He smiled again in his relaxed way. A sudden impulse seized me, and I held out my hand. "Diok means to drink. Will you let me buy you one later?" He looked at me for a long second before he laughed. It was an unrestrained, happy sound that came leaping straight from his chest. He shook my hand warmly.
"I just might at that."
Diok released my hand, looking behind me.
"Simon, did you bring us this one?"
"He brought me, actually." Simon seemed put out by my brief exchange with the doorman, but I couldn't guess why. "I don't think anyone can really take him anywhere." He handed a jot to Diok.
"I'll believe that," Diok said. "There's something about him I like. He's a little fey around the edges. I hope he plays for us tonight."
"I hope so, too," I said, and we moved inside. I looked around the Aeolian as casually as I could manage. A raised circular stage thrust out from the wall opposite the curving mahogany bar. Several spiraling stairways led to a second level that was much like a balcony. A smaller 3rd level was visible above that, more like a high mezzanine circling the room. Stools and chairs ringed tables throughout around the room. Benches were recessed into niches in the walls. Sympathy lamps were mixed with candles, giving the room a natural light without fouling the air with smoke.
"Well, that was cleverly done." Simon's voice was brittle. "Merciful Taylor, warn me before you try any more stunts, will you?"
"What?" I asked. "The thing with the doorman? Simon, you are jittery as a teenage whore. He was friendly. I liked him. What's the harm in offering him a drink?"
"Diok owns this place," Simon said sharply. and he absolutely hates it when musicians suck up to him. 2 span ago, he threw someone out of here for trying to tip him. He gave me a long look. Actually threw him, almost far enough to make it into the fountain.
Oh, I said, properly taken aback. I snuck a look at Diak as he bantered with someone at the door. I saw the thick muscles in his arm tense and relax as he made a gesture outside.
Did he seem upset to you? I asked.
No, he didn't. That's the damnedest thing.
Willem approached us.
If the two of you will stop fishwifing and come to table, I will buy the first drinks. Lynn?
We made our way to the table Willem had picked out, not too far from where Stanchion sat at the bar.
What do you want to drink?
Willem asked as Simon and I sat down and I settled my loot case into the 4th chair.
Cinnamon mead, Simon said without stopping to think.
Girl,
Willem said in a vaguely accusatory way and turned to me.
Cider, I said. Soft cider.
2 girls,
he said, and walked off to the bar. I nodded toward Stanchion.
What about him?
I asked Simon. I thought he owned the place.
They both do. Stanchion handles the music end of it.
Is there anything I should know about him? I asked, my near catastrophe with Diak having sharpened my anxiety.
Simon shook his head. I hear he's cheerful enough in his own right, but I've never talked with him. Don't do anything stupid and everything should be fine.
Thanks, I said sarcastically as I pushed my chair back from the table and stood.
Stanchion had a medium build and was handsomely dressed in deep green and black. He had a round, bearded face and a slight paunch that was probably only noticeable because he was sitting. He smiled and motioned me forward with the hand that wasn't holding an impressively tall tankard.
"Who's there?" he said cheerily. "You have the hopeful look about you. Are you here to play for us tonight?"
He raised a speculative eyebrow. Now that I was closer, I noticed that Stanchion's hair was a deep, bashful red that hid if the light struck him the wrong way.
"I hope to, sir," I said, though I was planning to wait for a while.
"Oh, certainly! We never let anyone try their talent until the sun is down."
He paused to take a drink, and as he turned his head, I saw a golden set of pipes hanging from his ear. Sighing, he wiped his mouth happily across the back of his sleeve.
"What do you play, then? Lute?"
I nodded.
"Have any idea what you'll use to woo us?"
"That depends, sir. Has anyone played the lay of Sir Savian Traliard lately?"
Stanchion raised an eyebrow and cleared his throat. Smoothing his beard with his free hand, he said,
"Well, no. Someone gave it a whirl a few months ago, but he bit off more than he could swallow whole. Missed a couple fingerings and fell apart."
He shook his head.
"Simply said, no, not lately."
He took another drink from his tankard and swallowed thoughtfully before he spoke again.
"Most people find that a song of more moderate difficulty allows them to showcase their talent," he said carefully.
I sensed his unspoken advice and was not offended. Sir Savian is the most difficult song I had ever heard. My father had been the only one in the troupe with the skill to perform it, and I had only heard him do it perhaps 4 or 5 times in front of an audience. It was only about 15 minutes long. But those 15 minutes required quick, precise fingering that, if done properly, would set 2 voices singing out of the lute at once, both a melody and a harmony. That was tricky, but nothing any skilled lutist couldn't accomplish. However, Sir Savian was a ballad, and the vocal part was a counter-melody that ran against the timing of the lute. Difficult. If the song was being done properly, with both a man and a woman alternating the verses, the song was further complicated by the female's counter-harmony in the refrains. If it is done well, it is enough to cut a heart. Unfortunately, few musicians could perform calmly in the center of such a storm of song. Stanchion drank off another solid swallow from his tankard and wiped his beard on his sleeve.
"You singing alone?"
he asked, seeming a bit excited in spite of his half-spoken warning.
Or have you brought someone to sing opposite you?
Is one of the boys you came with a castrati?
I fought down laughter at the thought of Willem as a soprano and shook my head. I don't have any friends that can sing it. I was going to double the third refrain to give someone the chance to come in as Eloine.
Trooper style, eh?
He gave me a serious look.
Son, it's really not my place to say this, but do you really want to try for your pipes with someone you've never even practiced with?
It reassured me that he realized how hard it was going to be. How many pipes will be here tonight, roughly? He thought briefly.
Roughly 8? Maybe a dozen?
So in all likelihood, there will be at least 3 women who have earned their talents. Stanchion nodded, watching me curiously.
Well, I said slowly, if what everyone has told me is true, if only real excellence can win the pipes, then one of those women will know Eloine's part.
Stanchion took another long, slow drink, watching me over the top of his tankard. When he finally set it down, he forgot to wipe his beard.
You're a proud one, aren't you?
He said frankly. I looked around the room. Isn't this the Aeolian? I heard that this is where pride pays silver and plays golden.
I like that, Stanchion said almost to himself. Plays golden.
He slammed his tankard down onto the bar, causing a small geyser of something frothy to erupt from the top.
Damn it, boy! I hope you're as good as you seem to think you are. I could use someone else around here with Ilion's fire.
He ran a hand through his own red hair to clarify his double meaning. I hope this place is as good as everyone seems to think it is, I said earnestly. I need a place to burn.
He didn't throw you out, Simon quipped as I returned to the table, so I'm guessing it didn't go as badly as it could have.
I think it went well, I said distractedly, but I'm not sure.
How can you not know? Simon objected. I saw him laugh. That must mean something good. Not necessarily, Willem said.
I'm trying to remember everything I said to him, I admitted. Sometimes my mouth just starts talking and it takes my mind a little bit to catch up.
This happens often, does it?
Asked Willem with one of his rare quiet smiles. Their banter began to relax me.
More and more often, I confessed, grinning.
We drank and joked about small things, rumors of the masters and the rare female students who caught our attention. We talked about who we liked in the university, but more time was spent mulling over who we didn't like, and why, and what we would do about it given the chance. Such is human nature. So time passed, and the Aeolian slowly filled. Simon gave in to Willem's taunting and began to drink Scutton, a powerful black wine from the foothills of the Shalda Mountains, more commonly called Cuttail. Simon showed the effects almost immediately, laughing louder, grinning wider, and fidgeting in his seat. Willem remained his same taciturn self. I bought the next round of drinks, making it large mugs of straight cider for each of us. I responded to Willem's scowl by telling him that if I made my talent tonight, I would float him home in Cuttail, but if either of them got drunk on me before then, I would personally thrash them and drop them in the river. They settled down an appreciable amount and began inventing obscene verses to Tinker Tanner. I left them to it, retreating into my own thoughts. At the forefront of my mind was the fact that Stanchion's unspoken advice might be worth listening to. I tried to think of other songs I could perform that were difficult enough to show my skill, but easy enough to allow me room for artistry. Simmons' voice drew me back to the here and now.
Come on, you're good at rhymes, he urged me.
I replayed the last bit of their conversation that I'd been half listening to.
Try In the Talon's Cassock, I suggested disinterestedly.
I was too nervous to bother explaining that one of my father's vices had been his propensity for dirty limericks. They chortled delightedly to themselves while I tried to come up with a different song to sing. I hadn't had much luck when Willem distracted me again.
What?
I demanded angrily. Then I saw the flat look in Willem's eyes that he only gets when he sees something he really doesn't like.
What?
I repeated more reasonably this time.
Someone we all know and love,
he said darkly, nodding in the direction of the door. I couldn't see anyone I recognized. The Aeolian was nearly full, and over 100 people milled about on the ground floor alone. I saw through the open door that night had settled outside.
His back is to us. He's working his oily charm on a lovely young lady who must not know him. To the right of the round gentleman in red.
Willem directed my attention.
Son of a bitch,
I said, too stunned for proper profanity.
I've always figured him for porcine parentage myself,
Willem said dryly. Simon looked around, blinking owlishly.
What? Who's here?
Ambrose.
God's balls, Simon said and hunched over the tabletop. That's all I need. Haven't you two made nice yet?
I'm willing to leave him be, I protested, but every time he sees me, he can't help but make another jab in my direction.
It takes two to argue, Simon said.
Like hell, I retorted. I don't care whose son he is. I won't go belly up like some timid pup. If he's fool enough to take a poke at me, I'll snap the finger clean off that does the poking. I took a breath to calm myself and tried to sound rational. Eventually, he'll learn to leave me well enough alone.
You could just ignore him,
Simon said, sounding surprisingly sober. Just don't rise to his baiting and he'll tire of it soon enough.
No, I said seriously, looking Simon in the eye. No, he won't.
I liked Simon, but he was terribly innocent at times. Once he thinks I'm weak, he'll be on me twice as thick as the day before. I know his type.
Here he comes,
Willem observed, looking casually away. Ambrose saw me before he made it to our side of the room. Our eyes met, and it was obvious that he hadn't expected to see me there. He said something to one of his ever-present group of bootlickers, and they moved off through the crowd in a different direction to claim a table. His eyes moved from me to Willem to Simon to my loot and back to me. Then he turned and walked to the table his friends had claimed. He looked in my direction before he took his seat. I found it unnerving that he didn't smile. He had always smiled at me before, an oversad pantomime smile with mockery in his eyes. Then I saw something that unnerved me even more. He was carrying a sturdy squared case.
Ambrose plays liar?
I demanded of the world in general. Willem shrugged. Simon looked uncomfortable.
I thought you knew, he said weakly. You've seen him here before?
I asked. Sim nodded.
Did he play?
Recited, actually. Poetry. He recited and kind of plucked at the lyre. Simon looked like a rabbit about to run.
Does he have his talent?
I said darkly. I decided then that if Ambrose was a member of this group, I didn't want anything to do with it.
No,
Simon squeaked.
He tried for it, but...
He trailed off, looking a little wild around the eyes. Willem laid a hand on my arm and made a calming gesture. I took a deep breath, closed my eyes, and tried to relax. Slowly, I realized that none of this mattered. At most, it simply raised the stakes for tonight. Ambrose wouldn't be able to do anything to disrupt my playing. He would be forced to watch and listen. Listen to me playing the Lay of Sir Savian Trelliard. Because now there was no question as to what I would be performing tonight. The evening's entertainment was led by one of the talented musicians from the crowd. He had a lute and showed that he could play it as well as any Ademaru. His second song was even better, one that I'd never heard before. There was a gap of about 10 minutes before another talented musician was called onto the stage to sing. This man had a set of reed pipes and played them better than anyone I had ever heard. He followed by singing a haunting eulogy in a minor key. No instrument, just his high, clear voice that rose and flowed like the pipes he had played before. I was pleased to find the skill of the talented musicians to be everything it was rumored to be. but my anxiety increased a proportionate amount. Excellence is excellence's only companion. Had I not already decided to play the Lay of Sir Savian Trailyard for purely spiteful reasons, these performances would have convinced me. There followed another period of 5 or 10 minutes. I realized that Stanchion was deliberately spacing things out to give the audience a chance to move about and make noise between the songs. The man knew his business. I wondered if he had ever been a trooper. Then we had our first trial of the night. A bearded man of 30 years or so was brought onto the stage by Stanchion and introduced to the audience. He played flute. Played it well. He played 2 shorter songs that I knew and 1/3 I didn't. He played for perhaps 20 minutes in all, only making 1 small mistake that I could hear. After the applause, the flutist remained on stage while Stanchion circulated in the crowd, gathering opinions. A serving boy brought the flutist a glass of water. Eventually, Stanchion came back onto the stage. The room was quiet as the owner drew close and solemnly shook the man's hand. The musician's expression fell, but he managed a sickly smile and a nod to the audience. Stanchion escorted him off the stage and bought something that came in a tall tankard. The next to try her talent was a young woman, richly dressed with golden hair. After Stanchion introduced her, she sang an aria in a voice so clear and pure that I forgot my anxiety for a while and was ensnared by her song. For a few blessed moments, I forgot myself and could do nothing but listen. Too soon, it was over, leaving me with a tender feeling in my chest and a vague prickling in my eyes. Simmons sniffled a little and rubbed self-consciously at his face. Then she sang a second song while accompanying herself on a half-harp. I watched her intently, and I will admit that it was not entirely for her musical ability. She had hair like ripe wheat. I could see the clear blue of her eyes from where I sat some 30 feet away. She had smooth arms and small, delicate hands that were quick against the strings, and the way she held the harp between her legs made me think of, well, the things that every boy of 15 thinks about incessantly. Her voice was as lovely as before, enough to set a heart aching. Unfortunately, her playing could not match it. She struck wrong notes halfway through her second song, faltered, then recovered before she made it to the end of her performance. There was a longer pause as Stanchion circulated this time. He milled through the 3 levels of the Aeolian, talking with everyone, young and old, musician and not. As I watched, Ambrose caught the eye of the woman on stage and gave her one of his smiles that seemed so greasy to me and so charming to women. Then, looking away from her, his gaze wandered to my table and our eyes met. His smile faded, and for a long moment we simply watched each other, expressionless. Neither of us smiled mockingly or mouthed small, insulting nothings to each other. Nevertheless, all our smoldering enmity was renewed in those few minutes. I cannot say with certainty which of us looked away first. After nearly 15 minutes of gathering opinions, Stanchion mounted the stage again. He approached the golden-haired woman and took her hand as he had the previous musicians. The woman's face fell in much the same way his had. Stanchion led her from the stage and bought her what I guessed was the consolation tankard. Closely on the heels of this failure was another talented musician who played fiddle, excellent as the 2 before him. Then an older man was brought onto stage by Stanchion as if he were trying for his talent. However, the applause that greeted him seemed to imply that he was as popular as any of the talented musicians who played before him. I nudged Simon. "Who's this?" I asked, as the gray-bearded man tuned his lyre. "Threp," Simon whispered back at me. "Count Threp, actually. He plays here all the time. Has for years. Great patron of the arts. He stopped trying for his pipes years ago. Now he just plays. Everyone loves him." Threp began to play, and I could see immediately why he had never earned his pipes. His voice cracked and wavered as he plucked his lyre. His rhythm varied erratically, and it was hard to tell if he struck a wrong note. The song was obviously of his own devising, a rather candid revelation about the personal habits of a local nobleman. But in spite of its lack of classic artistic merit, I found myself laughing along with the rest of the crowd. When he was done, everyone applauded thunderously, some people pounding on the tables or stamping as well. Stanchion went directly onto the stage and shook the Count's hand, but Threp didn't seem disappointed in the least. Stanchion pounded him enthusiastically on the back as he led him down to the bar. It was time. I stood and gathered up my loot. Willem clapped my arm and Simon grinned at me, trying not to look almost sick with friendly worry. I nodded silently to each of them as I walked over to Stanchion's vacant seat at the end of the bar where it curved toward the stage. I fingered the silver talent in my pocket, thick and heavy. Some irrational part of me wanted to clutch it, hoard it for later, but I knew that in a few more days a single talent wouldn't do me a bit of good. With a set of talent pipes, I could support myself playing at local inns. If I was lucky enough to attract the attention of a patron, I could earn enough to square my debt to Devi and pay my tuition as well. It was a gamble I had to take. Stanchion came ambling back to his spot at the bar. "I'll go next, sir, if it's all right with you." I hoped I didn't look as nervous as I felt. My grip on the loot case was slippery from my sweating palms. He smiled at me and nodded.
"You've got a good eye for a crowd, boy. This one is ripe for a sad song. Still planning on doing Xavier?"
I nodded. He sat down and took a drink.
"Well, then, let's just give them a couple of minutes to simmer and get their talking over with."
I nodded and leaned against the bar. I took the time to fret uselessly about things I had no control over. One of the pegs on my lute was loose, and I didn't have the money to fix it. There had not been any talented women on the stage yet. I felt a twinge of unease at the thought of this being the odd night where the only talented musicians at the Aeolian were men, or women who didn't know Eloine's part. It seemed only a short time before Stanchion stood and raised a questioning eyebrow at me. I nodded and picked up my lute case. It suddenly looked terribly shabby to me. Together, we walked up the stairs. As soon as my foot touched the stage, the room hushed to a murmur. At the same time, my nervousness left me, burned away by the attention of the crowd. It has always been that way with me. Off stage, I worry and sweat. On stage, I am as calm as a windless winter night. Stanchion bade everyone consider me as a candidate for my talent. His words had a soothing, ritual feel. When he gestured to me, there was no familiar applause, only an expectant silence. In a flash, I saw myself as the audience must see me. Not finely dressed as the others had been, in fact, only one step from being ragged. Young, almost a child, I could feel their curiosity drawing them closer to me. I let it build, taking my time as I unclasped my battered second-hand loot case and removed my battered second-hand loot. I felt their attention sharpen at the homely sight of it. I struck a few quiet chords, then touched the pegs, tuning it ever so slightly. I fingered a few more light chords, testing, listened, and nodded to myself. The lights shining onto the stage made the rest of the room dim from where I sat. Looking out, I saw what seemed to be a thousand eyes. Simon and Willem, Stanchion by the bar. Diok by the door. I felt a vague flutter in my stomach as I saw Ambrose watching me with all the menace of a smoldering coal. I looked away from him to see a bearded man in red. Count Threp. An old couple holding hands. A lovely, dark-eyed girl. My audience. I smiled at them. The smile drew them closer still, and I sang. "Still, sit, for though you listen long, long would you wait without the hope of song. So sweet is this, as Ilion himself set down an age ago. Master work of a master's life, of Savian and Eloine, the woman he would take to wife." I let the wave of whisper pass through the crowd. Those who knew the song made soft exclamation to themselves, while those who didn't asked their neighbors what the stir was about. I raised my hands to the strings and drew their attention back to me. The room stilled, and I began to play. The music came easily out of me, my lute like a second voice. I flicked my fingers and the lute made a third voice as well. I sang in the proud, powerful tones of Savian Treliard, greatest of the Aemir. The audience moved under the music like grass against the wind. I sang as Sir Savian, and I felt the audience begin to love and fear me. I was so used to practicing the song alone that I almost forgot to double the third refrain. But I remembered at the last moment in a flash of cold sweat. This time, as I sang it, I looked out into the audience, hoping at the end I would hear a voice answering my own. I reached the end of the refrain before Eowyn's first stanza. I struck the first chord hard and waited as the sound of it began to fade without drawing a voice from the audience. I looked calmly out to them, waiting. Every second a greater relief vied with a greater disappointment inside me. Then a voice drifted onto the stage, gentle as a brushing feather, singing, "Savian, how could you know? It was the time for you to come to me. Savian, do you remember the days we squandered pleasantly? How well, then, have you carried what have tarried in my heart and memory?" She sang as Eowyn, I as Savian. On the refrains her voice spun, twinning and mixing with my own. Part of me wanted to search the audience for her, to find the face of the woman I was singing with. I tried once, but my fingers faltered as I searched for the face that could fit with the cool moonlight voice that answered mine. Distracted, I touched a wrong note and there was a burr in the music. A small mistake. I set my teeth and concentrated on my playing. I pushed my curiosity aside and bowed my head to watch my fingers, careful to keep them from slipping on the strings. And we sang. Her voice like burning silver, my voice an echoing answer. Savian sang solid, powerful lines, like branches of a rock-old oak. All the while, Eowyn was like a nightingale, moving in darting circles around the proud limbs of it. I was only dimly aware of the audience now, dimly aware of the sweat on my body. I was so deeply in the music that I couldn't have told you where it stopped and my blood began. But it did stop. Two verses from the end of the song, the end came. I struck the beginning chord of Savian's verse, and I heard a piercing sound that pulled me out of the music like a fish dragged from deep water. A string broke. High on the neck of the lute, it snapped, and the tension lashed it across the back of my hand, drawing a thin, bright line of blood. I stared at it numbly. It should not have broken. None of my strings were worn badly enough to break. But it had. And as the last notes of the music faded into silence, I felt the audience begin to stir. They began to rouse themselves from the waking dream I had woven for them out of the strands of song. In the silence, I felt it all unraveling. The audience waking with the dream unfinished, all my work ruined, wasted. And all the while burning inside me was the song, the song, the song! Without knowing what I did, I set my fingers back to the strings and fell deep into myself, into years before, when my hands had calluses like stones and my music had come as easily as breathing. Back to the time I played to make the sound of wind turning a leaf on a lute with six strings. I began to play, slowly, then with greater speed as my hands remembered. I gathered the fraying strands of song and wove them carefully back to what they had been a moment earlier. It was not perfect. No song as complex as Sir Savian can be played perfectly on six strings instead of seven. But it was whole. And as I played, the audience sighed, stirred, and slowly fell back under the spell that I had made for them. I hardly knew they were there, and after a minute, I forgot them entirely. My hands danced, then ran, then blurred across the strings as I fought to keep the lute's two voices singing with my own. Then, even as I watched them, I forgot them. I forgot everything except finishing the song. The refrain came, and Eowyn sang again. To me, she was not a person, or even a voice. She was just a part of the song that was burning out of me. And then it was done. Raising my head to look at the room was like breaking the surface of the water for air. I came back into myself, found my hand bleeding and my body covered in sweat. Then the ending of the song struck me like a fist in my chest, as it always does, no matter where or when I listen to it. I buried my face in my hands and wept. Not for a broken lute string and the chance of failure. Not for blood shed and a wounded hand. I did not even cry for the boy who had learned to play a lute with 6 strings in the forest years ago. I cried for Sir Savian and Eloine, for love lost and found and lost again, at cruel fate and man's folly. And so, for a while, I was lost in grief and knew nothing. Chapter 55 Flame and Thunder. I held all of my mourning for Savian and Eloine to a few moments. Knowing I was still on display, I gathered myself and straightened in my chair to look out at my audience, my silent audience. Music sounds different to the one who plays it. It is the musician's curse. Even as I sat, the ending I had improvised was fading from my memory. Then came doubt. What if it hadn't been as whole as it had seemed? What if my ending hadn't carried the terrible tragedy of the song to anyone but myself? What if my tears seemed to be nothing more than a child's embarrassing reaction to his own failure? Then, waiting, I heard the silence pouring from them. The audience held themselves quiet, tense, and tight, as if the song had burned them worse than flame. Each person held their wounded selves closely, clutching their pain as if it were a precious thing. Then there was a murmur of sobs released and sobs escaping. A sigh of tears, a whisper of bodies slowly becoming no longer still. Then the applause, a roar like leaping flame, like thunder after lightning. Chapter 56 Patrons, Maids, and Metheglin. I restrung my lute. It was a fair distraction while Stanchion gathered opinions from the crowd. My hands went through the routine motion of stripping the broken string away while I fretted to myself. Now that the applause had died, my doubts had come to plague me again. Was one song enough to prove my skill? What if the audience's reaction had been due to the power of the song rather than my playing of it? What of my improvised ending? Perhaps the song had only seemed whole to me. As I finished removing the broken string, I gave it an idle look and all my thoughts fell to a jumble at my feet. It wasn't worn or flawed as I had thought it would be. The broken end was clean, as if it had been cut with a knife, or snipped with a pair of scissors. For a while, I simply stared at it dumbly. My lute had been tampered with? Impossible. It was never out of my sight. Besides, I had checked the strings before I left the university, and again before I had come on stage. Then how? I was running the thought in circles in my head when I noticed the crowd quieting. I looked up in time to see Stanchion take the last step onto the stage. I hurriedly got to my feet to face him. His expression was pleasant, but otherwise unreadable. My stomach tied a knot as he walked toward me, then it fell as he held out his hand the same way he had held it out for the other two musicians who had been found wanting. I forced my best smile onto my face and reached to take his hand. I was my father's son and a trooper. I would take my refusal with the high dignity of the Edema Rue. The earth would crack and swallow this glittering, self-important place before I would show a trace of despair. And somewhere in the watching audience was Ambrose. The earth would have to swallow the Aeolian, Imre, and the whole Senthesea before I gave him a grain of satisfaction over this. So I smiled brightly and took Stanchion's hand in my own. As I shook it, something hard pressed into my palm. Looking down, I saw a glimmer of silver. My talent pipes.
My expression must have been a delight to watch. I looked back up at Stanchion. His eyes danced, and he winked at me. I turned and held my pipes aloft for everyone to see. The Aeolian roared again. This time, it roared a welcome.
"You have to promise me," a red-eyed Simon said seriously, "that you will never play that song again without warning me first. Ever."
Was it that bad? I smiled giddily at him.
"No!"
Simon almost cried out. I've never..." He struggled wordless for a moment, then bowed his head and began to cry hopelessly into his hands. Willem put a protective arm around Simon, who leaned unashamedly against his shoulder.
"Our Simon has a tender heart," he said gently. "I imagine he meant to say he liked it very much."
I noticed that Willem's eyes were red around the edges, too. I lay a hand on Simon's back. "It hit me hard the first time I heard it, too," I told him honestly. "My parents performed it during the midwinter pageantry when I was 9, and I was a wreck for 2 hours afterward. They had to cut my part from the swineherd and the nightingale because I wasn't in any shape to act." Simon nodded and made a gesture that seemed to imply that he was fine, but that he didn't expect to be able to talk any time soon, and that I should just carry along with whatever I was doing. I looked back at Willem. "I forgot that it hits some people this way," I said lamely.
"I recommend scutting," Willem said bluntly. "Cuttail, if you insist on the vulgar. But I seem to remember you saying that you would float us home tonight if you got your pipes, which may be unfortunate, as I happen to be wearing my lead drinking shoes."
I heard Stanchion chuckle behind me.
"These must be the two non-castrati friends, eh?"
Simon was surprised enough at being called a non-castrati to collect himself slightly, rubbing his nose on his sleeve. "Willem, Simon, this is Stanchion." Simon nodded. Willem gave a slight, stiff bow. "Stanchion, could you help us to the bar? I've promised to buy them a drink."
"Tss," Willem said. "Drinks."
"Sorry, drinks," I stressed the plural. "I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for them."
"Ah," Stanchion said with a grin. "Patrons, I understand completely."
The Victory Tankard turned out to be the same as the Consolation one. It was ready for me when Stanchion finally managed to get us through the throng of people to our new seats at the bar. He even insisted on buying scutton for Simon and Willem, saying that patrons have some claim to the spoils of victory as well. I thanked him earnestly from the bottom of my rapidly thinning purse. While we were waiting for their drinks to come, I tried to peer curiously into my tankard, and found that doing so while it was sitting on the bar would require me to stand on my stool.
"Metheglen," Stanchion informed me. "Try it and you can thank me later. Where I am from, they say a man will come back from the dead to get a drink of it."
I tipped an imaginary hat to him.
"At your service." "Yours and your family's," he replied politely.
I took a drink from the tall tankard to give myself a chance to collect my wits, and something wonderful happened in my mouth. Cool spring honey, clove, cardamom, cinnamon, pressed grape, burnt apple, sweet pear, and clear well water. That is all I have to say of Metheglen. If you haven't tried it, then I'm sorry I cannot describe it properly. If you have, you don't need me to remind you what it is like. I was relieved to see the cuttail had come in moderately sized glasses, with one for Stanchion, too. If my friends had received tankards of the black wine, I would have needed a wheelbarrow to get them back to the other side of the river.
"Dusavian,"
Willem toasted.
"Hear, hear,"
Stanchion said, lifting his own glass.
"Savian,"
Simon managed, his voice sounding like a stifled sob. "And Aeloine," I said, and maneuvered my great tankard to touch glasses with them. Stanchion drank off his scutton with a nonchalance that made my eyes water.
"So,"
he said, "before I leave you to the adulation of your peers, I have to ask, where did you learn to do that?"
play missing a string, I mean.
I thought for a moment. Do you want the short or the long of it?
I'll take the short for now.
I smiled.
Well, in that case, it's just something I picked up.
I made a casual gesture as if tossing something away. A remnant of my misspent youth. Stanchion gave me a long look, his expression amused.
I suppose I deserve that. I'll take the long version next time.
He took a deep breath and looked around the room. His golden earring swung and caught the light.
I'm off to mix the crowd. I'll keep them from coming at you all at once.
I grinned relief. Thank you, sir. He shook his head and made a peremptory motion to someone behind the bar, who quickly fetched him his tankard.
Earlier tonight, sir, was proper and good, but now it's Stanchion.
He glanced back in my direction, and I smiled and nodded.
And I should call you?
Quoth, I said. Just Quoth.
Just Quoth, Willem toasted behind me.
And Aelwene, Simon added, and began to cry softly into the crook of his arm. Count Threp was one of the first to come to me. He looked shorter up close, and older, but he was bright-eyed and laughing as he talked about my song.
Then it broke, he said, gesturing wildly, and all I could think was, not now, not before the ending. But I saw the blood on your hand and my stomach knotted up. You looked up at us, then down at the strings, and it got quieter and quieter. Then you put your hands back on the lute, and all I could think was, there's a brave boy. Too brave. He doesn't know he can't save the end of a broken song with a broken lute. But you did!
He laughed as if I'd played a joke on the world and danced a quick jig step. Simon, who had stopped crying and was on his way to becoming well-buttered, laughed along with the count. Willem didn't seem to know what to make of the man, and watched him with serious eyes.
"You must play at my house some day,"
Threp said, then quickly held up a hand.
"We won't talk of that now, and I won't take up any more of your evening," he smiled. "But before I go, I need to ask you one last question. How many years did Savian spend with the Emir?"
I didn't have to think about it. 6. 3 years proving himself, 3 years training.
Does 6 strike you as a good number?
I didn't know what he was getting at. 6 isn't exactly a lucky number, I hedged. If I were looking for a good number, I'd have to go up to 7, I shrugged. Or down to 3. Threp considered this, tapping his chin.
You're right. But 6 years with the Emir means he came back to Aelwene on the 7th year.
He dug into a pocket and brought out a handful of coins of at least 3 different currencies. He sorted 7 talents out of the mess and pushed them into my surprised hand.
My lord, I stammered, I cannot take your money.
It wasn't the money itself that surprised me, but the amount. Threp looked confused.
Why ever not?
I gaped a little bit, and for a rare moment I was at a loss for words. Threp chuckled and closed my hand around the coins.
It's not a reward for playing. Well, it is that, but it's more of an incentive for you to keep practicing. Keep getting better. It's for the sake of the music.
He shrugged.
You see, a laurel needs rain to grow. I can't do much about that. But I can keep that rain off a few musicians' heads, can't I?
A sly smile wound its way onto his face.
So God will tend the laurels and keep them wet, and I will tend the players and keep them dry, and wiser minds than mine will decide when to bring the two together.
I was silent for a moment. I think you might be wiser than you give yourself credit for.
Well, he said, trying not to look pleased. Well, don't let it get around, or people will start expecting great things from me.
He turned and was quickly swallowed by the crowd. I slid the 7 talents into my pocket and felt a great weight lift from my shoulders. It was like a stay of execution, perhaps literally, as I had no idea how Devi might have encouraged me to pay my debt.
I drew my first carefree breath in 2 months.
It felt good.
After Threp left, one of the talented musicians came to offer his compliments. After him, it was a Sealdish moneylender who shook my hand and offered to buy me a drink. Then there was a minor nobleman, another musician, and a pretty young lady that I thought might be my Eloine until I heard her voice. She was the daughter of a local moneylender, and we talked of small things, briefly, before she moved on. I remembered my manners almost too late and kissed her hand before she left. They all blurred together after a while. One by one they came to give me their regards, compliments, handshakes, advice, envy, and admiration. Though Stanchion was true to his word and managed to keep them all from coming at me in a mass, it wasn't long before I began having trouble telling one from another. The Metheglin wasn't helping matters either. I'm not sure how long it was before I thought to go look for Ambrose. After scanning the room, I nudged Simon with an elbow until he looked up from the game he and Willem were playing with Shims. "Where's our best friend?" I asked. Simon gave me a blank look, and I realized that he was too far into his cups to catch sarcasm. "Ambrose," I clarified. "Where's Ambrose?"
"Scuffled off," Willem announced with an edge of bellicosity. "As soon as you finished playing, before you'd even got your pipes."
"He knew. He knew," Simon sing-song delightedly. "He knew you would get them and couldn't bear to watch."
"Looked bad when he left," Willem said with a quiet malice. "Pale and shaking. Like he'd found out someone had been lanting in his drinks all night."
"Maybe someone was," Simmons said with uncharacteristic viciousness.
"I would."
"Shaking?" I asked. Willem nodded.
"Trembling. Like someone had gut-punched him. Linton was giving him an arm to lean on when he left."
The symptoms sounded familiar, like binder's chills. A suspicion began to form. I pictured Ambrose listening to me glide through the most beautiful song he'd ever heard and realizing I'm about to win my pipes. He wouldn't do anything obvious, but perhaps he could find a loose thread or a long splinter from the table. Either one would provide only the most tenuous sympathetic link to my lute string, 1% at best, perhaps only a tenth of that. I imagined Ambrose drawing on his own body heat, concentrating as the chill slowly worked into his arms and legs. I pictured him, trembling, his breath growing labored until finally the string breaks, and I finish the song in spite of him. I grinned at the thought. Pure speculation, of course, but something had certainly broken my lute string, and I didn't doubt for a second that Ambrose would try something of the sort. I focused back in on Simon. "Eat up to him and say, 'No hard feelings about that time in the crucible when you mixed my salts and I was nearly blind for a day. No, no, really, drink up! Ha!'" Simon laughed, lost in his own vengeful fantasy. The flood of well-wishers slowed somewhat. A fellow lutist, the talented piper I'd seen on stage, a local merchant, a heavily perfumed gentleman with long, oiled hair and a vintic accent clapped me on the back and gave me a purse of money, 4 new strings. I didn't like him. I kept the purse.
"Why does everyone keep going on about that?" Willem asked me.
"About what?"
"Half the people that come over to shake your hand bubble about how beautiful the song was. The other half hardly mention the song at all. And all they talk about is how you played with a broken string. It's like they didn't hardly hear the song at all."
"The first half don't know anything about music," Simon said. "Only people who take their music seriously can really appreciate what our little Elir here did tonight." Willem grunted thoughtfully.
"It's hard then, what you did?"
"I've never seen anyone play Squirrel in the Thatch without a full set of strings," Simon told him.
"Well," he said, "you made it look easy. Since you have come to your sense in pushing aside that Yeelish fruit drink, Will you let me buy you a round of fine dark scutton, drink of the kings of Kildom?
I know a compliment when I hear it, but I was reluctant to accept as I was just beginning to feel clear-headed again. Luckily, I was saved from having to make an excuse by Maria coming to pay her respects. She was the lovely golden-haired harper who had tried for her talent and failed. I thought for a moment that she might be the voice of my Eowyn, but after a moment's listening to her, I realized it couldn't be. She was pretty, though, even prettier than she had seemed on stage, as is not always the case. Talking, I found she was the daughter of one of Imre's councilmen. Against the tumble of her deep golden hair, the soft blue of her gown was a reflection of the deep blue of her eyes. Lovely as she was, I couldn't give her the concentration she deserved. I itched to be away from the bar to find the voice that had sung Eowyn with me. We talked a while, smiled, and parted with kind words and promises to speak again. She disappeared back into the crowd, a wonderful collection of gently moving curves.
"What was that shameful display?" Willem demanded after she had gone.
"What?" I asked.
"What?"
he mocked my tone.
"Can you even pretend to be that thick? If a girl as fair as that looked at me with one eye the way she looked at you with two, we'd have a room by now to say it carefully."
"She was friendly," I protested, "and we were talking. She asked me if I would show her some harp fingerings, but it's been a long time since I played harp."
"It'll be a lot longer if you keep missing passes like that," Willem said frankly. "She was doing everything but taking down another button for you."
Sim leaned over and lay his hand on my shoulder, the very picture of the concerned friend. "Quoth, I've been meaning to talk to you about this very problem. If you honestly couldn't tell that she was interested in you, you might want to admit the possibility that you are impossibly thick when it comes to women. You may want to consider the priesthood." "The both of you are drunk," I said to cover my flush. "Did you happen to notice from our conversation that she's a councilman's daughter?"
"Did you notice," Will replied in the same tone, "how she looked at you?"
I knew I was woefully inexperienced with women, but I didn't have to admit to it, so I waved his comment away and got down off my stool. Somehow I doubt that a quick romp behind the bar was what she had in mind. I took a drink of water and straightened my cloak. "Now, I must go find my Eowyn and offer her my earnest thanks. How do I look?"
"What does it matter?"
Willem asked. Simon touched Willem's elbow. "Don't you see? He's after more dangerous game than some low-bodiced councilman's daughter." I turned from them with a disgusted gesture and headed off into the crowded room. I didn't really have any idea how I would find her. Some foolish romantic part of me thought I would know her when I saw her. If she were half as radiant as her voice, she would shine like a candle in a dark room. But as I thought these things, the wiser part of me was whispering in my other ear. "Do not hope," it said. "Do not dare hold hope that any woman could burn as brightly as the voice that sang the part of Eowyn." And while this voice was not comforting, I knew it to be wise. I had learned to listen to it on the streets of Tarbian, where it had kept me alive. I wandered through the first level of the Eowyn, searching without knowing who I was looking for. Occasionally, people would smile or wave. After 5 minutes, I had seen all the faces there were to see and moved to the second level. This was actually a converted balcony, but instead of tiers of seats, there were rising ranks of tables that looked onto the lower level. As I wended my way through the tables, looking for my Eowyn, my wiser half kept murmuring in my ear, "Do not hope. All you will earn is disappointment. She will not be as beautiful as you imagine, and then you will despair." As I finished searching the second level, a new fear began to rise in me. She might have left while I was sitting at the bar, drinking in Metheglin and praise. I should have gone to her straight away, fallen to one knee, and thanked her with my whole heart. What if she was gone? What if no one knew who she was or where she had gone? A nervousness settled into the pit of my stomach as I took the stairs to the highest level of the Eowyn. "Now look what your hope has gotten you,"
the voice said. "She is gone, and all you have is a bright, foolish imagining to torment yourself with." The last level was the smallest of the three, hardly more than a thin crescent that hugged three walls, high above the stage. Here, the tables and benches were more widely spaced and sparsely populated. I noticed that the inhabitants of this level were mostly couples, and I felt something of a voyeur as I passed from table to table. Trying to appear casual, I looked at the faces of those who sat talking and drinking. I grew more nervous the closer I came to the last table. It was impossible for me to do so casually, as it was in a corner. The couple sitting there, one light-haired and one dark, had their backs to me. As I approached, the light-haired one laughed, and I caught a glimpse of a proud, fine-featured face, a man. I turned my attention to the woman with the long, dark hair. My last hope. I knew she would be my Eloine. Coming round the corner of the table, I saw her face, or rather, his face. They were both men. My Eloine had left. I had lost her. And with that knowledge, I felt as if my heart had been tipped from its resting place in my chest to topple and fall somewhere deep inside me, near my feet. They looked up, and the fair-haired one smiled at me. "Look, Threa, young Sixstring has come to offer us his respects." He eyed me up and down. "You're a fair one. Would you like to join us for a drink?" "No," I murmured, embarrassed. "I was just looking for someone." "Well, you found someone," he said easily, touching my arm. "My name is Fallon, and this is Threa. Come and have a drink. I promise to keep Threa here from trying to take you home. He has a terrible weakness for musicians." He smiled charmingly at me. I murmured an excuse and took my leave, too distraught to worry whether or not I had made an ass of myself. As I made my desolate way back to the stairs, my wise self took the opportunity to berate me. "That is what comes of hope," it said. "No good. Still, you are better having missed her. She could never have been equal to her voice. That voice, fair and terrible as burning silver, like moonlight on river stones, like a feather against your lips." I headed to the stairs, eyes on the floor lest anyone try to catch me in a conversation. Then I heard a voice like burning silver, like a kiss against my ears. Looking up, my heart lifted, and I knew it was my Eloine. Looking up, I saw her, and all I could think was beautiful. Beautiful.